Hi everyone, welcome back to the Transmission Podcast. I'm Wendell, and in this episode, I'm joined by Niall Brady from the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, or CEFC. This is Australia's government-owned green bank and a massively influential institution in the clean energy space. We're diving into how the CEFC has helped to unlock investment into grid-scale battery energy storage and other clean technologies, and what it really takes to make these projects investable. We also talk about the role of policies such as the Capacity Investment Scheme, where capital is missing from the market, and how the CEFC sees the future of energy storage playing out. This was a really interesting conversation, especially if you're looking to understand how finance helps to shape the energy transition. As always, hit like, subscribe, all that good stuff. Let's dive in. Hi, Niall. Welcome to the Transmission Podcast.
Hey, Wendell. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Really excited to have you on. Can you start off with just giving a bit of an introduction to yourself and your role at the CEFC?
Yeah. So Niall Brady, Head of Solar and Storage at the CEFC, Clean Energy Finance Corporation. The CEFC is the Australian government's green bank. We started about 12 years ago with $10 billion, and now we've got about $32 billion. We invest debt and equity for the Australian government. We have an independent board and an independent investment process. In the $32 billion, we have $19 billion in the Rewiring the Nation Fund, which is investing in Australia's poles and wires that we need for the future. And we have $13 billion in the general fund, we call it. And that's investing in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and low emissions technology. Our object is to facilitate flows of finance into the clean energy sector and to facilitate the Australian government's greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets. My job in solar and storage has changed a lot over the years. I've been there 10 years. There was a time when solar was non-commercial, and we were there. So we were one of the early investors in solar in Australia, really pushed through the early projects along with ARENA and their large-scale solar round. And then that just took off. So we've been from pre-commercial to a boom to probably a bit of a lull to, and I feel it's coming back now at the moment. And yeah, a similar story in storage also feels, given the progress we've made in the last few years, feels hard to imagine a time when storage didn't exist. But yeah, look, we started, we were the first investor first debt investor in storage in Australia, way back into Hornsdale. We've been very active in the market. We've taken a bit of risk, but it's played out okay so far. And I think we're in that pre-commercial to what I would consider boom at the moment. And I also cover the longer end duration of storage, which is in the difficult bucket, but we're trying hard and we will work alongside other people to try and make that happen. I don't think financing alone is the answer to that.
Yeah, maybe we'll come on to that later. Just to pick up on what you were saying in terms of the CEFC's involvement in some of the kind of earlier battery energy storage projects. Yeah, can you maybe talk through a few of those? Kind of what were they, when were they put together and where are they?
Yeah, so look, we're there since the start. So back on Hornsdale, and you look now and it looks like an easy investment. You did it at the time and there was a lot of uncertainty, and it took a lot of courage from our exec and board to kind of go, yeah, we believe in this. We want to get the market moving, and we're happy to put our risk capital behind it. So look, I would say that was really born out of a great relationship we have with Neoen, that we could sit down together and say, look, we're going to figure this out. Nobody's invested. I would say uninvestable at the time. The banks weren't there. There was contracted revenue, but there was an element of merchant in there as well. And trying to get a forecast at the time was difficult.
Yeah.
FCAS was a bit of an unknown, and Energy Arb was who knows. What we did at the time, we wanted to be a debt investor, but we realized that project finance would not suit an asset like that. Scheduled principal and interest against a revenue stream so volatile was going to be difficult. We believed in the long-term value of the revenue stream, but we couldn't pick the volatility. So what we did is we financed on a sweep basis. So we effectively profit shared. We were debt, but we profit shared out. And we set a base case where we said we'd be out in, say, 8 to 10 years. And we thought that, oh yeah, if all goes to plan, we'll be out in 8 to 10 years. We enforced our security as debt by, if it went a bit slower, we could allow it to go longer. But if it went longer, we upped our sweep to pay us down quicker. Now, What actually happened, I would say we were paid out in less than half that time because Hornsdale went amazingly. And that really started us off. And we were the only debt investor in the market at that time. And then we came on and with Neo N again and Victorian Big Battery, still the market hadn't taken off. Victorian Big Battery, for given our policy objectives, was a great asset for us. It had a SIPS contract to allow the...
So SIPS.
Oh, system. Oh, God.
Yeah, I think it's System Integrity Protection Service.
That sounds lovely. I'll tell you what it does. I won't tell you what the acronym stands for. It had a contract that effectively... the redundancy on the New South Wales Victorian Interconnector, it allowed that to be released for the summer month to allow the flows from New South Wales to Victoria, which, virtual transmission, I think we'd call it. And that for us was great. But what it left was a project with a strange profile, which had was nearly fully contracted for 5 months and was merchant for 7 months. So we again did kind of a sweep arrangement to get that going. And then as we moved on from there, we were really keen to develop the market further and get more lenders involved. So on our next project, which was the first virtual offtake in Australia, Capital Battery, and we really went out and went around to the banking market and tried to get people to co-lend beside us. We were happy to lend, but then we wanted people in beside us, and we worked, and eventually Alexander Austin and Infradet came into beside us on that, and that was another interesting, just pushing the boundaries on contracting structures. And I think that's going to be the flexibility of batteries, that's going to be an ever-evolving space, I think.
Yeah, it's something here I think that is so, you know, it's developed within the Australian market for battery storage is on the contracting side. Yeah, the kind of array of different sort of long-term like kind of agreements that are out there to support, you know, revenues for batteries is at the moment, I'd say, fairly unique to this market.
Yeah, and look, it's a unique market and there's plenty of value there at the moment. So I think it's really encouraging people to look hard, you know, like they can see the observable spreads and they're going, yep, I want to be involved in that. And then look, as we move on further than that, Warrada Super Battery was another one. And another one of those ones you look at now and you think it's big, but it's fairly standard. But at the time we were in the middle of a COVID supply chain shock and delivering on to the tight deadlines was a real risk at that. So BlackRock and Acacia came to us and they were keen to do it on an ungeared basis. So we came in as equity on that with a substantial ticket to help support that in what is a new asset class and a new risk profile for a lot of the co-investors. So we were happy to stand beside that. And look, that's been another one. You look at it and how it's went, and it's a credit to Acacia and the team, Nick and Richard Reynolds, have really pushed it through and like it's making some really good progress. But at the time it was there was some interesting conversation about, well, can you get cells out of China?
I think it seems like it got kind of turned around relatively on time for such a big system, right?
Look, and at that time there was people telling us like some of the main providers were like, couldn't provide a battery until 2026, couldn't provide a battery until 2027. So it required a lot of ingenuity in the how to source a battery like that and get it built on time.
Awesome. And so I guess, if I was to kind of summarize that, maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong. Yeah, so I guess the CEFC's involvement on the battery energy storage side in Australia has, like you said, projects which now maybe don't seem so big in the scheme of things, but at the time they were, even globally, kind of like market leading projects in terms of the size of batteries being built. And so your role, well, CFC's role was really to be the kind of vanguard of actually supporting the financing of those projects. Is that right?
Yeah, look, and I think that the risk profile as well, taking merchant risk, you know, wasn't probably on batteries, wasn't done at the time, you know, like, so coming in and taking that, a lot of the batteries that were built at the time were balance sheeted effectively. So we were probably one of the first to move on that. We were keen to get batteries moving. We saw their value and we've been amazed by how quickly they started moving and how it seems so mainstream now, but at the time it felt so niche and we really wanted to support it. So kind of what we do with our risk appetite is we point it at places we think need help and we point it at batteries and look, it's paid off.
Yeah, given like you said, I mean, there's now kind of, I guess, a lot more involvement from sort of banks in the sector who are willing to kind of fund these projects. Is there still a role for CFC in these big battery storage energy storage projects, or are you looking at other ways to deploy that funding?
Yeah, look, I think our role's definitely changed. We're not the only person in town anymore. And the development of the market has been so quick. Solar probably took 4 or 5 years to get to what batteries did in 12 months. You know, just the speed at which the banks came to it, became comfortable with the risk, became comfortable with the element of merchant risk has been key. And also, look, we look at the transition of Australia and, yeah, there's numbers between $70 and $1 billion need to be invested between here and 2030. And, look, we don't have the capital to be in every deal. So when a market is really rolling and going well, we're happy to let the private sector do it. We're not here to crowd anyone out. And I think on something like batteries at the moment, we're probably dealing with specific risks as they come up. You know, like we'll be involved on an ad hoc, we'll react to the market and be involved on an ad hoc basis as needed, and where we can do something that will get a project or make a project work that won't happen elsewhere. But we're seeing a lot of private sector interest at the moment, which is keeping us quiet.
Yeah.
and look, I think our focus at the moment, if we had to point our risk focus somewhere, probably wind is probably behind where we need to be and struggling a bit in cost. So we probably, our risk and return focus is probably focused on wind a bit more, and very interested in kind of solar storage hybridization coming through.
Yeah, awesome. And I think just to, I guess, wrap up kind of the bit around battery energy storage, like has, yeah, over the kind of length of those projects, I guess Hornsdale came online in 2017. How has like kind of investment case for battery energy storage changed over that time? You mentioned kind of now taking on more merchant risk. Yeah, how has that evolved?
Batteries have changed. You know, the technology has changed and the cost has changed. But also as we get more batteries into the market, I think that the fundamental business case has moved away from frequency control to energy arbitrage. And look, the falling prices allowed batteries to do that. So I think our revenue stack looks far different. But then we look at the market coming in to invest in those. And then we've really seen a change in that. And we're seeing a lot of inbound. Like, I do really like your graph that says 14 gigawatts are committed, because I've been telling everyone that with a fairly dodgy spreadsheet for a long time. And it's great to have someone else's graph to point at. But so this is a market that's evolving really quickly. And what I think is probably most interesting is that the market we are looking at today, if you're investing today, that is not the market you get built into, because I think by the end of next year, you're going to have at least 10 gigs of competition. And I think that's going to be really interesting. So we're really keen to see how that plays out. I see a very interesting time next year or two. And look, a lot of markets have struggled kind of after they've had the initial boom of batteries in. They've struggled for revenue just as everyone started to cannibalize each other a bit. And I think that over the long term, it'll work out. But I can see some short-term pain just around, you know, if the system still looks the same basically as this year, but next year we have an extra 10 gigawatts of batteries competing in the peak, I think they're going to compete with each other. I think they'll and seasonally it'll look very different. I think we'll push gas out for long periods. And then when a battery competes with a battery, what's its marginal cost and where does it bid? I think is going to be a really interesting one, you know, because it is going to want to use its power outside solar hours because it knows the next day it can charge at zero or negative again.
So just for context, today in May 2025, I mean, there's kind of just over 2 gigawatts, maybe 2.5 gigawatts of actually commercially operational battery energy storage. But yeah, so within probably, yeah, by the end of 2026, that could have doubled twice to get to that 10 gigawatt number. I mean, just quickly, actually, because yeah, you mentioned earlier the kind of how the volatility of battery revenues can impact things like financing. Obviously, that's not unique to the NEM, but I would say some of the volatility that batteries see is, does that change, you know, what is required in terms of like a financing package that you put together for a battery?
I think you have to look at the package on the whole, you know, so like you look there and there's usually a portion of merchant revenue and a portion of contracted revenue, you know, and you'll run downsides. I do think you probably need a bit more flexibility in the way you structure around it. Like, you know, the revenue may not turn up this quarter, but like, and one, you could have one great quarter.
Yeah.
And I think years may, like, as we, I think seasonally batteries are going to look very different, and we may start seeing that like, you know, they're relying on one great quarter and a few quiet quarters. And I think that as an equity sponsor, making sure that you can ride through that and you're not defaulting in any way to the banks is going to be key. You know, you want to, I think anyone who invests in batteries that can buy some flexibility in the timing will be key. In volatile commodities, buy time and you'll be okay. They'll come right at some stage, but there will be times when it won't quite be there. And I think having hard principal and interest requirements around that will be difficult.
Yeah, like you said, with the amount of storage coming online, it kind of does raise probably a bit of short-term risk about what could happen in the market.
I think in the longer term, it'll be fine. And there'll be periods we'll have the messy transition. It won't be a messy transition every year, but you will get years of messy transition. You know, that's kind of where we will get outages, we will get unplanned, we will get weather events, but you may well get periods where you don't get those. So there's a volatility of volatility, I think, is what you need to be able to ride through.
Yeah, it makes like forecasting difficult as well.
It's an art, not a science.
Yeah. So, yeah, you kind of mentioned at the start, your role encompasses, I guess, both solar and storage. Is there a difference today in terms of the investment case of both those technologies? Like, we know that there's a really strong pipeline for grid-scale storage. Is that the same now still for solar?
Yeah, so look, I think development pipeline-wise, solar has no problem. The barriers to developing are relatively low, and I think there's a big development pipeline there, and it can respond relatively quickly. You know, it doesn't have the lead time of wind. Look, and I think solar has probably been in the doldrums. Rooftop is killing it largely, but I see a real future for solar. I think storage is going to be the key to unlocking all that solar, and I think... Look, there's an opportunity happening at the moment, which I think is really going to push a lot more solar and storage into the system than we expected. The ISP is running out to 2030, about 80% wind, 20% solar. If you look at the CIS Tender 1, it was about 50-50. The makeup of the CWRO RES, it was about 50-50. I think we're going to end up on kind of a 50-50. And I think that the opportunity is there, both because the fall in storage prices, but the price of wind has gone so high. Like, you know, like, so we've seen an almost doubling of the price of wind. And I think that's the key factor. So solar and storage is going to become very competitive in displacing wind. And then look, the knock-on effects of that. If your system is 50-50 solar and storage versus wind, do you build the same grid? Do you build the same reses? You know, like, how does that work out? Because if we're following the ISP and we're building a system for 80% wind, but we actually end up at 50, you know, are we building the least cost system?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, you know, yeah, what would you say is driving that? So yeah, because if I'm, let's say, an investor looking to deploy some capital into the clean energy transition in Australia, and maybe in my head I had wind, but now I'm looking at the CapEx, which is significantly higher than it was previously, then I'm going to look at alternatives.
Yeah. And look, I think there's two lenses you can look at it, cost and value. And value is valuing the swaps, you know, like, and saying, okay, what kind of a wind, what can I offer a wind swap at, and what can I offer a solar swap at, and what's the NPV of that? I think, but it's also coming to a stage of just on cost, you know, like you're coming, if you start to get storage down to 300K a megawatt, you know, you start getting very competitive with wind at three and a half million, you know, like it starts getting very, very competitive. Yeah, I think ultimately economics will drive it. It always does. Yeah. And I think that you could look what can I offer that PPA from my wind project at? And from what I'm hearing, they may have three digits in them. You know, that's kind of what's been said around the market. And you look at, okay, what price does storage have to be at a duration that would be comparable to wind that I could do a three-digit PPA?
Yeah. I mean, really interesting to see what happens there, because I think, yeah, we've got the first like kind of true hybrid projects coming online. Well, maybe towards the end of this year, next year for sure.
Yeah. So we've been involved in, with Octopus, we've been involved in Fulham and Blind Creek, and they're both through 534A, DC coupled. And we're seeing, I think Gentari have an asset, Maryvale, coming through DC coupled. And I've seen one come through in Queensland as well, 534A. So yeah, I think that's probably a frontier that's currently being tackled. What we find is that people are getting the first of a kind asset up is difficult. It's very hard to get all your approvals and get your connection and get everyone across the line and get your EPC contractors across the line. But once they've been in a market a while, people really get comfortable. And we've seen the same on batteries. You know, like there's one thing when you're modeling how a battery works, you know, theoretically, but then when people can see them in the grid and see their capability, they feel differently about them.
And so yeah, I guess, is that like hybrid project of solar and storage, is that, you know, a big focus of yours now then?
Yeah, look, we're really keen to see it come through. And ultimately, look, we're an investor. We need, like, you know, we invest very close to where the market is. And I think that us alone wouldn't drive it through, but I think cost will drive it through, you know, like, and economics. And we're keen to support. I think it's a bit of a coming wave that we will see. And I expect most solar to probably be hybridized in some form coming forward.
So, yeah, we discussed kind of onshore wind. Would you say there's any other financing gaps, like kind of in the, you know, electricity transition in the NEM?
Yeah, so look, this comes to the long end of storage in my book. Look, and I think we definitely have a gap there. If we think about it, and just look from a federal level, what do we need for a reliable system? Well, we need to have enough megawatt hours, and the CIS is driving in megawatt hours. We need to be able to move it around the day to match the load, and the CIS, say, driving in the storage, and that we will have enough storage to match that. But then we need effectively insurance. What happens when we don't have enough megawatt hours provided by renewables? And then you come to looking at, okay, I need non-correlated generation. And the non-correlated generation can be, well, what's in the ISP is a big lump of flexible gas and some long-duration storage. And it's effectively a plug for the reliability generation. So we don't currently have a federal policy which deals with that. The CIS doesn't go beyond 4 hours. It's difficult. It's going to be expensive given the current market construct. Longer durations are not rewarded by arbitrage, which is why you can get the shorter durations up relatively easy on a commercial basis. You can't get the longer durations. And I think that we support schemes like the 8-hour Altesa. We see Queensland through Queensland Hydro and the Gox all promoting their pump storage, and we'd be keen to support that. But I really think that to address the energy transition in its entirety, we've got to have an answer to what happens when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. And that is that piece of the ISP, which is the flexible gas or long duration storage.
And so obviously, yes, yeah, so Snowy kind of 2.0 gets the headlines, but there are other pumped hydro projects kind of in the works. If you look at kind of what's in the development pipeline there, is there enough or do we need to find more?
Yeah, look, I think there's enough in the near term. I would say about Snowy 2.0, I don't think it should be considered by the market, the investing market, as pump storage. It's not your poster child pump storage. Nobody digs that length of tunnel. It makes a lot of sense around the Snowy scheme that you do that, but I think probably more like Genesis Kidston plant is probably far more like a typical pump storage. But we're seeing projects come through. We see in Queensland, Queensland Hydro of Barumba, all of the GOCs have their own smaller projects. So like there is a pipeline up there that's being developed. New South Wales, they had the New South Wales recoupable grants process, which really kind of primed the pump. And you're seeing the fruits of that coming through. So we had ASIM win a pump, Phoenix Pumped Hydro win the 8-hour Altesa. And I know there's a few other viable projects around, like Oven Mountain.
We'll come on to like Altesa in a second. But then other technologies providing this long-duration energy storage? There's a few batteries in there.
Yeah, look, we're seeing 8-hour batteries. And it's funny to look over the time we've been covering it. We used to have a map which had hour 1 and 2 was going to be lithium ion. Hour 2 to 8 was anybody's. And then longer than 8 was pumped hydro. And in that 2 to 8, we were seeing a mixture of technologies we were seeing. And there was all, they had this pathway. And we've really just seen that the cost of the lithium ion has just driven it out into that, driven that middle ground away, you know, like, so we're now seeing it win 8-hour tenders, and then pumped hydro even becomes just the longest of the deepest storage becomes pumped hydro, but lithium ion is making that middle ground difficult for people.
Yeah, and I think so. Yeah, like all the kind of these long duration batch projects we've seen have come through the Altesa, which is, I guess, yeah, New South Wales focused kind of support scheme, which does have that, you know, long duration target. So these schemes, so Altesa and the CIS, how do they play into the bankability of a project? Like, do they make it easier for you to go and finance these things?
Oh, look, we are really supportive of these mechanisms, right? We need to fundamentally transform our energy sector. Right? And what you get with just the market as is incremental change, and we need fundamental change. So the LTESA and the CIS standing there and taking risk is going to be key. Do they help bankability? Yes. What I would say about an LTESA or CIS is you could bid it for 15 years at a cap and floor of $200 and an unlimited annual cap, and you would have a $200 government-backed PPA. That is the outside of what you could have, which is, unbelievably bankable. And then it gets watered down as people bid and get more aggressive and stack it with other things. It gets less. And trying to get that balance between, okay, making it aggressive and a winning bid and getting it bankable is going to be the key.
Yeah, I think it's something that there's not that much transparency, I guess, to date over sort of what's been awarded. So I think that's something we're quite keen to understand more of. So one other thing that's going on, I guess, is the Nelson Review, which is asking these same questions, but much longer term. Has CFC made a sort of submission to that review, or do you have any thoughts on it?
Look, we've had various meetings with Tim and the crew, and we are fully supportive of what they're doing. Look, I think there's a recognition there that the system is changing. We have rules set for an old system that was based around thermal generation, and we're going to have a different system going forward. And I think that that point we had about long duration and what the Nelson Review is calling firming, I think is going to be the key. We don't have a capacity mechanism. How are we going to make sure that we have those kind of insurance megawatt hours sitting in the system for when we need them?
Awesome. And so beyond power, obviously there's a much wider kind of energy transition. A lot of it is the electrification of things like industry, transport. Is that something that the CEFC plays a role in, and what could that look like?
So the CEFC's remit has always been wider than just electricity. Despite the name, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, we have roughly 50%, or we have a requirement for 50% of our investment to be renewable, but then we operate outside that. So we've got big platforms in anywhere we can get decarbonisation in the Australian government. Decarbonisation, like even we look at 2030, I think you look at electricity is probably the low-hanging fruit. 82% renewable will drive a lot of the decarbonisation, but we also need input from transport and agriculture to drive that through. So we have a debt capital markets team, which really tries to reach out to the customer, and that's really driving electrification both of the home. We have the Housing Energy Upgrade Fund, and in transport. So we have a lot of kind of EV type products that we try and drive, and we use our concessionality there to drive it down to end consumers to make that choice more attractive. But we also operate kind of over the horizon a little bit. So we have Powering Australian Technology Fund investing at kind of an earlier stage, and we have a hydrogen fund. We are very broad.
a lot of fingers in many pies. And so the one thing we've not really touched on, I guess, is the grid. And you mentioned the kind of the Rewiring the Nation Fund at the start. So yeah, what does the CEFC's involvement in a lot of the transmission infrastructure that needs to be built out look like?
Yeah, so the government have trusted the CEFC to run the $19 billion Rewiring the Nation Fund. And look, that effectively is going to be, we are going to be in every res. We are there to build out the grid we need for the future. What does that involvement look like? Look, we will work with state, federal government, TNSPs, and we will fill holes as we can. We will plug the gaps. I think if we look at the objectives of that, it's to expedite it as quickly as possible and to at the least cost to consumer. So we are very active in that space, and I think we're probably only starting to see the announcement of deals. I think we'll see a lot coming through in the next year or two.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned the size of some of these funds at the beginning. Actually, yeah, how does that grid fund compare to the other sort of investment pots that you have?
Well, we've got $32 billion and 19 of it is for Rewiring the Nation. I think that shows the commitment that's there from the federal government to get the future grid build out.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really great to see the involvement there, because I think there's so much that needs to be done on the transmission network to support the build out of all the renewable generation that looks like it needs to come online. And so finally, to wrap up, we always end with kind of two questions. The first of which, Niall, is there anything you would like to plug?
Well, plugging, I don't have gaps in the financing market would be, but look, we don't have products or projects that we're wedded to, you know, like we're there to react to the market. But what I would say we have been working with the market in the last while is just how you consider a CIS or LTESA and the differences between what is your typical project. We're used to projects which had kind of a portion of merchant and a portion of contracted, and the merchant and contract effectively operate independently of each other. And what we are trying to tell people is that, look, each LTESA or CIS should be looked at on its own merits, because fundamentally the LTESA affects the merchant position. So I'll give you an example. You have a fully merchant project. You make a dollar of revenue. You have a dollar of merchant revenue. You have a CIS with a floor of 80. You need to make $81 to make a dollar of merchant revenue. So like, I feel that at extra dollar above 80 is far higher risk than the dollar starting at zero. So you just got to look at each one on its own merits. Annual caps come into it, and the specifics of the transaction. So we've been doing a lot of work with kind of banks and advisors just to try and work through that. We're financial modelers at heart at the CEFC, so we love this stuff.
And so we always finish with the same question, which is, what is your contrarian view?
Well, I've got a few, but I had to think about this one, and it's not that popular with my battery clients, but I have a defense of Snowy Hydro. So Snowy 2.0, I look at it and I think that it's an ambitious nation building project, and everyone says, oh, but the cost has gone crazy. Well, I look at, say, $12 to $14 billion cost, say, and you look at 2.2 gigawatts of generation. But what you've got to realize is on the loop, you also have Tamit 1 and Tamit 2. So you free up another 600 megawatts. So you get to nearly 3 gigs of pump storage capacity and available generation. And then you kind of go, okay, well, $12 billion and we're getting 3 gigawatts. You know, that's four and a half million a megawatt is that's costing. I look at people building wind for three and a half to 4 million a megawatt, and I think that's not bad value. And I also think something like Snowy, you've got to appreciate that the lifespan of an asset like that's a gift to your kids. You know, that's going to be around a long time. And as well, from a government balance sheet, was the right place to build it. But from a government perspective, it has been a boom to the regions. It is Australian made storage, you know, like which we can't say about a lot of our technologies, but like it is a massive civils task. It has been a boom to the regions, employment. So yeah, I'm a big supporter.
Yeah, I would say, so plug from my personal side is, if anyone ends up in the Snowy Mountains in Kosciuszko, I don't know how to pronounce that, National Park, go have a look at the Snowy scheme. It's actually kind of immense, the scale of it and the technology that was done. And I mean, a lot of the first projects were, you know, 60, 70 years ago now. So it's very impressive what's there.
Well, I can say I was lucky enough to go visit Snowy 2.0, and I was just getting there. You appreciate the sheer scale of the system and the project that's ongoing and the number of people working there and the pride they have in what they're doing.
Awesome. Well, Niall, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's great to have you here. And thanks everyone who's listening.
Thank you very much.